And up, that the thing was high. It was lifted up. You wanted to be lifted up. It lifted you up. You had to cooperate, of course. I always like the illustration that I've used before, perhaps you haven't heard it, of the thistledown. The thistledown, too, comes moving through the sky. I once was playing with the thing, you know, and just came out of the blue sky, and I caught it like that, pulled it under my nose, and it started to pull, to get away, see? It looked as if it were a butterfly or something that pulls away when you catch it by the leg. And I thought, oh no, of course, that's not the thistledown, it's the wind. Well, which was it? You know, in a famous debate that was settled by the sixth patriarch of Zen, there were two monks arguing when a flag was flapping in the wind, whether it was the wind or the flag that was moving. And he said, it's neither, it's the mind. And so in a way, the same thing was true about the thistledown. The mind is the moving thing, because which point of view will you take? Which attitude of mind will you take towards this? Is it the wind moving the thistledown? Or is it the thistledown that is moving itself with the wind? After all, when you see a sailing boat, and there's a man in the sailing boat, who is moving the boat? Is it the wind moving the boat? Or is it the man moving the boat because he was smart enough to put up a sail? Much smarter way of getting around than rowing. You don't have to work. It's intelligence, you see, the mind that moves the boat. And so in the same way, I thought, you know, this thistledown has some kind of intelligence. It's radial, it's organized, it's beautiful. And it's used that to sail itself with the wind, to enable itself to pull like a little organism playing with the wind. And so in just the same way, each one of us uses the universe to get around, and the universe uses us to play with and to make games and patterns and to do its stuff. So because we seem to be disconnected and entirely sealed within our skin, that is a very deceptive thing, because the skin is not really the boundary of man. You'll notice that in various periods of art, human beings have been shaped in different ways. And have been more or less transparent at some times, at other times opaque, and sometimes the emphasis has been on the state of mind which this human being is in. At other times, the emphasis is on the bodily conformations, and so on. In the work of painters today, one sees images that at first sight one doesn't recognize as being human. There was an exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in New York some years ago called The New Image of Man. And these things didn't look like human beings at all. Some of them did, but that's because what does a human being look like? That depends on your point of view. You see, if you are prejudiced that a human being is only what is inside his skin, then you think that when anybody paints the human being beyond those boundaries, that he's lost the image of man. He hasn't necessarily lost it at all. You see, there's an old feeling that the shape of the universe is the shape of man. I don't know if you've ever heard that said. That man is the microcosm, and that the universe as a whole is the macrocosm. Now, as you plumb out into the universe and explore it astronomically, it gets very strange. You begin to see things in the depths that at first sight seem utterly remote. How could they have anything to do with us? They are so far off and so unlikely. And in the same way, when you start probing into the inner workings of the human body, you come across all kinds of funny little monsters and wiggly things that bear no resemblance to what we recognize as the human image. look at a spermatozoan under a microscope, that little tadpole. And how can that have any connection with a grown human being? It's so unlike, you see. It's foreign feeling. And you get the creep sometimes, the foreign feeling about yourself, if you feel your own pulse. Or if you're able to look at an X-ray in some way of your inner organs working. See, they're all strangers to us. We don't know about them. And they give us the creeps as if they were, you know, coming across some weird insects in the dark. That sort of feeling. But what we will always find out in the end, you see, when we meet the very strange thing and we look into the distant reaches of space, there will one day be the dawning recognition, that's me. Why, that's me. And the whole game of the universe, you see, is to appear as strange to itself as it possibly can. That's how one keeps variety going. That's how one keeps wonder going and all kinds of exciting developments. How different can you get? In the beginning, the Lord said, get lost to himself, you see. So we shall find, for example, that space that you see all around you and containing you, and you can feel space in many ways. Space is not only something that comes through the eyes. The movement of your arms, if with closed eyes, if for a blind person, is his way of knowing space. And you can hear space audibly. Lots of sounds appear to be in restricted spaces or ample spaces. And silence that goes with sound corresponds to space. And even St. Thomas Aquinas, that old Catholic theologian, said that good derives its virtue from evil, just as it is the silent pause that gives sweetness to the chant. So, but space, you see, that seems to contain, space is one's mind. This was common sense to people living in the early Renaissance, for example, at the time of Dante. There are many references in Dante's poetry to the identity of mind and space. And in likewise, in a 8th century text in China, the Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch, he likens the nature of mind to the nature of space. He says, just as space contains all the sun and the moon and the stars and the people and the mountains and the forests, so the nature of mind, the nature of consciousness, the nature of oneself contains all these things. So you see that if you think that way, you have an image of man that is global, that is very different from the image in which man is defined as bounded by his skin. That's a prejudice. We think now, for example, I have my own private thoughts. Well, nobody has private thoughts. Because one thinks in images and words, and these words and images are derived from the whole thought structure of the society in which you live. We think thoughts, the domain of mind is very similar to the grid structure of an electric power supply system. You know, what happens is there's a network of power stations and transformers so arranged that if one of them gives out and fails to supply a certain area, immediately the grid connects them with other sources of power. Well, in rather a similar way, our minds are connected. Let's take one very obvious example of it. What Northrop Frye calls the order of words. The order of words is all existing literature. Both rhetoric, what is spoken, of course, and what is written down. Now, it's his theory that as a scholar, of literature and the history of literature, he can take any piece of writing of a reasonable length and tell you when it was written. Because everything that is written and said is inescapably related to the whole order of words. And it's amazing what little things you might not notice would give you away. Because he can say, well, obviously he has read this, thinking, say, of a particular novelist or poet. So it must come after the date when that novel was published. But he couldn't possibly use an expression like that to say, for example, that it was a capital day. He would never use that expression living, say, in contemporary 20th century America. That's a Victorianism, or it's an Edwardian way of talking. And so, by all sorts of little clues like that, the scholar can pin down a piece of writing to when it was written, you see? That is because every individual piece of writing is a function of all writing that's being done. Well, now that's a very specific and almost crude illustration of something that's going on in a far more complicated way than that. It isn't only all writing, all thinking is being done in relation to the total order of thought. And in a still more subtle way, all living is being done in relation to the total order of life, to what de Chardin calls the biosphere, and it goes way beyond that. Because of the vast interplay of what we now call gravitational and electrical fields, which embrace everything that there is. That is why the ancients, when a person was born, cast his horoscope. That was a map of the universe at the time of that person's birth. And therefore it was a drawing of his soul. Because the soul is not inside the body. The body is inside the soul. The soul, your soul, is the whole universe as it is focused upon your organism. Now, of course, astrology is a very primitive science. And it interpreted the influence of the universe upon the individual in very crude ways. And it works mostly by good guesswork on the part of the astrologer. If you know how to tell fortunes at a fair, you will find out a great deal about how all these predictive psychic sciences work. Because the client invariably gives himself away. either by his anxiety to be told the truth or by his anxiety to conceal it. They work equally well. Now, But there is, you see, underneath the astrological notion, a sound idea that the true map of the soul is the picture of the universe surrounding the individual. It isn't necessarily your soul is not the picture of the universe just at the moment when you were born, you see. It goes along all the time you live because the whole thing expresses itself through you. And therefore, in that sense, the map of the stars, the horoscope, etc., was an image of man in just the same way as we regard a picture of the human body as an image of man. And it's an image from a different point of view. It's a bigger image. It shows, in other words, that your mind is very largely outside your body. After all, it's inside too, it's simultaneous. You see, I cannot think, I can't have a mind without seeing, feeling, and relating to other people. Without all the social institutions, not only language, but the laws, the customs, the gestures, the rituals by which we relate to each other. All those things compose the mind. For the mind is a huge network of relationships and interconnections at a high level of sensitivity. Mind and matter are, of course, polar. They go together. They're two ways of thinking about the same thing, or shall we say two dimensions of the same thing, just like length and breadth, or just, shall we say, like shape and color. You see, nobody ever saw a shape that wasn't colored. Nobody ever saw a color that wasn't shaped. And yet we can see there's a very clear difference between color and shape. But they always go together, they're always found together. Well, it's the same sort of relationship between mind and matter. And the difficulty that people have in trying to reduce one to the other and saying, well, the world is only material, or saying, on the other hand, that it's only mental, is the same difference you would have in trying to reduce all shapes to colors or all colors to shapes. Shape and color are made for each other, like a marriage made in heaven. They go together so perfectly and yet stay so marvelously different. That's why the Buddhists say, difference is identity. Identity is difference. It sounds goofy, but it makes a great deal of sense, because what it's saying is a relational thing, that you don't know what identity is unless you know what difference is, and you don't know what difference is unless you know what identity is. That relationship between so-called opposites is called in the Chinese technical Taoist vocabulary mutual arising. So they say to be and not to be arise mutually. High and low are mutually posited. Long and short are mutually delineated, and so on. Now, what we see then is the totality of the cosmos focused at each point, you see, gives rise to the illusion of the independence of the point from the whole. Just as the human being, by virtue of having an enclosed epidermis and to be able to walk instead of having to be rooted to the ground, presents the illusion of being separate. And so that's why I asked Vada to do these demonstrations last night, because he showed visually the interdependence of the figure and the background, and how the two play together, how you can switch from paying attention to one to paying attention to the other, and in each case it's significant. That is an art that we have lost in our day-to-day perception of life, and it leads, practically speaking, to the serious problem of ecological blindness. That is to say, to the ignorance which most human beings seem to suffer from, especially in our culture, that they are inseparably related to their physical environment. It looks as if we aren't. It looks as if we can go out with bulldozers and insecticides and every kind of a gadget and make over our physical environment as it suits our whims. But then we discover, to our consternation, that we've upset all sorts of balances, that the house we made such a nice flat lot for on the hillside suddenly slides down the hill when there's a rainstorm because we took away all the shrubbery that was binding the hill together. And, you know, this happens in Hollywood every day. And and nobody ever seems to learn. And that's, you see, this immense importance of overcoming the illusion of separateness. But people are afraid of that because they think it's communistic. They think that the grand style, the great thing about Western civilization, is its stress on individual personality and its value. and that we have created the ideal of personal integrity. That is to say that the most important thing in the world is the individual. All collectivities, corporations, states, and so on, exist as servants of the individual. And if they get in his way and they interfere with his private enterprise, whatever that may be, it's a bad thing. Man, the individual, is the crown of creation from this point of view. And therefore, when anybody suggests that individual man is not what you thought was an individual, but is in some way united with, grounded in the totality, then if you're this kind of rugged individualist, you mix up your vocabulary and you call the totality the collective. Now, the collective and the totality are two completely different things. The idea of